Should we get started? Okay. Can I ask a question from me? Can I ask a question from me, please? Okay, we're going to get started with me. So I have a question about your use of Psalm 24 that you present as the leadership of Jerusalem saying as he arrives at the city to deliver them. So I have two questions of confusion about how you're using that psalm in that situation. One, my understanding is Zechariah 14, when he arrives, he actually splits the mountain so they can run out of the city,
right?
Not welcome
I think
into
a company
it.
Of a battalion is true, not the entire city.
Okay, but then in Psalm 24, if you look at the context of Psalm 24, it talks about, you know, who may ascend the hill of the Lord, who may go into his holy place, clean hands, pure heart. And then it says, be lifted up, ye gates, be lifted up, you everlasting doors. The gates that they're welcoming him into in that context are not everlasting. Does it not fit better for that to be a type of commemorative song sung when he enters into the millennial temple in Ezekiel 43?
Probably it's all together, all one big reality.
That's not one big reality. It's two completely different situations. Okay, we'll move on.
Yeah, because I don't think there's a bunch of people inside the temple, and they're going, who are you? Why do you want in? Because I'm Jesus. You know, I've been here. I built this temple. Would you open the door for me? Tell me who you are. They don't know who he is. Go ahead. They're asking, who are you?
Yes. But
and he's just done battle.
My point being, does it have to be they're literally saying, who is this? Or can it simply be them making a statement, a rhetorical statement as part of the song, welcoming
Could
him
be.
In through the Eastern Gate, going, who is this King of Glory? This is the Lord strong and mighty, the Lord who is mighty in battle.
How long does it take him to build that temple?
What does that have to do with my
Because
question?
We're going to wait a couple years before we talk about the Lord mighty in battle. Say what? 6 years ago.
Well, how do you explain the everlasting doors that they say be lifted up then, if we're going to go that direction?
Yes.
Be lifted up
yes.
your everlasting
Excellent.
Doors.
I think it's one big reality, and we don't have to separate those. Meaning the temple, the city, the leaders, the born again, they're all getting saved. Everybody's in it together.
Mine will be a little bit simpler. It's also 24, but it's Revelations 24. Where, why when he talks about?
21 verse 24?
20 verse 4.
20 verse 4.
Oh, 20 verse
20
4.
Verse 4. And we go ahead and he talks about that the souls of those beheaded. Why did he use the term souls? Would they not have the resurrected bodies?
Yeah. Yeah.
Why souls? Is he waiting just for some other
Same
time?
As hers, just yeah.
It's just one big reality. It's just all one big reality. Just it just works together. Okay. You use that answer a lot, I'm just saying. Okay.
Well, I think it's way more than meets the eye. I think scores of things are layered. And you think it's there, and then it happens more, and then you think it's there. Well, then it happens one more time. Like, yeah. Whoa! Yeah. And probably the new heaven and new earth is going to happen again. My guess is that it happened in David's day, undoubtedly, when he was bringing the ark in. Probably he thinks he did it. He goes, well, not exactly, David. Almost. But so I think it is layered over and over. I mean, not 100 layers, but 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, more than we guess. So has anybody got an answer on the souls? Hey, we're going to answer your souls question. I just want these guys to lean into it.
Lean into it.
I don't.
You don't know?
No, I think... I've got thoughts, but
oh,
he knows.
I mean, in Acts, it says that many souls were saved.
That many souls were saved in the book of Acts. There you go. So soul doesn't have to mean invisible part of your humanity. It can if you're contrasting it with your physical, but you're saying it didn't have to.
Yeah. And it also
Never thought about it. Yeah.
Oh,
the souls of men in Revelation 18 are sold.
That's
interesting.
I think there's something to be explored in the book of Revelation related to how John uses that word. I think there's a lot more to that word that can be answered in a quick Q&A. There's the souls of the martyrs under the altar. There's the souls of those that were exchanged, not just their bodies. There is a differentiation in Revelation 18.
So Revelation 18, souls of your body, is physical and internal.
Right.
Souls in Revelation 6 seems like the invisible part, the internal part.
Right.
So it's, we don't know for sure. Souls in Acts 4 is the whole person. Huh. So your point is, which is it, or you don't know for sure?
I'm thinking that we would need time to go study the word usage, because there's something more there that could be answered quickly right now.
Good, yeah, because I don't know. That's the best answer I know.
Okay, I'm just going to read this. I'm trying to understand it, so I'm just going to read it. Maybe you will. Regarding the phrase for 1 hour, how do we know what this time period refers to, as it is appearing four times in these last two chapters, Revelation 17, 12, 18, 10, 17, and 19. Chapter 17 appears to be a different time frame, quote, for 1 hour, than chapter 18's.
That's right. I think you're right.
They have power or authority for an hour with the beast.
And destroyed in 1 hour seems like two different meanings. Huh. I don't think we've teased that one out.
No.
Because there's three or four of them, and then there's the short time that Satan, you know, the Revelation 12:12 for short time. And then the kings, do they have power for 1 hour or
one
for
hour.
A short time? There's another short time somewhere. There's two short times in Revelation. So I'm wondering, yeah, we got to put them all together, line them up together. Good question. Yeah. Very good question.
Okay. My question is concerning the role of the saints in the procession, because in Psalm 149, it says that the saints will bind the kings in irons. And in Matthew, in the parable of the 10 minas or whatever, he says, bring these enemies of mine to me and slaughter them before me. Are the saints binding the kings and bringing them to Jesus as he slaughters them?
I think, again, it's the answer that Moira loves, I think, is a little of this and a little of that. No, I don't think there's one thing. There's millions of people. One group does this, another group's doing that, another person's killed this way, another person dies in the flood. I just don't think one way.
I'm asking this because of Isaiah 26 and Habakkuk 3 and Isaiah 63, meaning if he is walking through Edom but passing over Judah in 26, because Isaiah 26 says he commands the Jews to go hide in their houses as he passes over Judah. But if he's coming into Judah after Edom, but he's walking on land, how is he passing over them? So I'm not sure how is he marching through Edom but passing over Judah, because he has to go back into the sky somehow.
Why does Passover have to mean in the air?
Well, because the word literally, the word there is to pass above. It means to be above the people you're passing over. That's why. So it's actually more literal than the word marching in
Habakkuk
Isaiah
3.
63 and Habakkuk 3, where it's passing through.
And what verse is that?
So it's the Passover one?
Yeah.
It's Isaiah 26. I could read it for you.
While you're looking for it, your initial question?
I'd like to get it. Yeah.
Your initial question.
The reason I'm asking that is because if he's
I want to answer it.
If he's walking through Edom and he's slaughtering people and blood is getting on his garments, I understand, because it seems like the reason we think he's walking through Edom is because he must be on the ground to get stained. But if the saints are bringing the kings to him and he's slaughtering them,
well, what if it's both?
Well, I don't know. It could be both. I'm just saying that I'm confused, because if he's on the ground in Edom, and then back above.
And where's the verse at?
Isaiah 26 is at the bottom. It's okay. The passage.
I'm there.
Do you have the NASB? The NASB is where it says Passover.
Okay, what verse do you have?
Let me open up Isaiah here. Come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors. Verse 20.
Oh, 20.
Behind you, hide yourself for a little while until the fury has passed by. That word passed by in the NASB is pass over.
Oh, this one says hide yourself until the indignation has passed.
Yeah. Well, the word there is to come to pass by or pass over.
You mean like the Passover?
Yes, like the Passover.
And so that, back to your earlier point, you don't want to, in this discussion, who brings who to whom, when do they bring it, is Jesus on the ground, is he in the air? The one piece of data you want to remove just for the sake of conversation is the parable. Because the parable of Jesus is not trying to build a theology of whether saints come to him in the judgment. You can't take that detail and build your understanding of the
narrative. That's why I brought Psalm 149 in.
Yeah, you got to just look at Psalm 149.
Yeah, I added
Matthew 25.
Yeah, I added Matthew 25 only as additional to Psalm 149. That's why. But my point is, I'm really confused by all these verses where he's passing over Judah, walking through Edom, slaughtering people.
But the problem is, if you take out Matthew 25, then you don't have a strong place, unless there's another passage where they're
Psalm
bringing.
Psalm 149 actually is, I mean.
I think we should move on.
Yeah, sorry.
No, don't you be sorry. But I don't think we should spend 8 minutes on this, because we sit down and talk. I'm just saying, all the other folks in the room that aren't that tuned into it, they're going, okay. But that is worth us teasing out, yeah.
Yes.
But I like this Isaiah 6:26 verse 20. That's a good one to look at. I'm going to check that one out.
But Passover, and the idea of Passover, just real quick, doesn't necessarily demand that Jesus be in the air to do it any more than it demanded that Jesus be in the air during the Passover during Moses.
Hey, wait, the guy ain't got a microphone. You can't answer him now.
He's over there. I got it. He's my friend.
I know.
Okay, moving on. A question from Mary. Please explain, this is a question from last week. Please explain who is speaking in Revelation chapter 18, verse 20, saying, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." It seems like it's the kings of the earth, merchants and sailors who participated and benefited from Babylon's acts who are mourning and crying out because of her fall torment.
Doesn't strike me it's the merchants and kings doing that. I think it's the voice of the Spirit. That's my assumption. I mean, that's just my, without having never thought about it real deep. Yeah.
Okay.
It's not incongruent or inconsistent with the rest of Revelation, where angels are constantly addressing the church to rejoice, to don't take the mark. There's this the angels are constantly interjecting things throughout the narrative.
Okay. Just like a small clarifying question, and depending on how you answer it, I'll ask a different question. I've kind of heard it taught around here, and Mike, you mentioned it a little, you hinted it a little bit last week, that the lake of fire will be in Edom. Is that something that
I think it's very possible, yeah.
So
I wouldn't say it will be. I would say it's possible. That seems likely to me.
Like based on Isaiah 34, you would say?
Yeah, and 3, 4, 5 places.
Okay.
Where there's forever smoke coming up in the same geographic area. It's about 100 miles. There's 2 or 3 cities it says it of, but they're within about 100 miles connection.
Yeah.
So it's like a big hole.
So I'm wondering how, to take that literally, and then to take the size of the New Jerusalem literally. I actually looked up a picture on Google, and this guy had made a little New Jerusalem paper cube, and he'd put it over the Middle East. And it covers the entire Middle East. So how are those that are going to be in the lake of fire going to be outside the city, but it's going to be in Edom, and the New Jerusalem covers the entire Middle East?
My guess is that when the new heavens, new earth comes, there's no sea. It's probably resting on where the Mediterranean Sea is.
But wouldn't that kind of go against the fact that the Jerusalem right now is the center and the city of the great king? Why would it all of a sudden move somewhere else?
Oh, no, not all of a sudden. Okay. It's 1,500 miles. Jerusalem's 10 miles now, but it'll be 1,500 miles. So I think it goes from Euphrates probably all the way over to Spain, I guess. There's got to be a big geographic area that is not a country now where part of it's resting on.
Okay.
That's a guess. And that's the only free space I know about, because there's not going to be any sea.
Please explain whether or not Jesus stepping down on the Mount of Olives and the land opening up is connected to the great earthquake of Revelation 16.
Could. No, it could. Yeah. I mean, it. You don't know.
It seems like that earthquake is global.
The Revelation 16 one, yeah.
I mean, mountains crumble, islands flee away. I mean, that's a pretty catastrophic earthquake that seems to be more than Jesus touching ground and causing an earth to split.
Yeah.
This is something. This is an earthquake of another order, it seems.
The strongest in history, yeah. Every island shakes.
And I think I would connect the global earthquake. I mean, just in my mind, I connect it more with every high and lofty thing being brought low. And that it is a the Lord alone being exalted as a bigger statement that includes what's happening in Jerusalem, and maybe the big earthquake is what splits the mountain, but it's, I would say it's more than just that.
And I think of the Mount of Olives being split as like the Red Sea being split. I'm thinking of soldiers, but not all the soldiers, not the whole city, but a group is stuck against it, and Jesus splits it like the Red Sea. And they, as it says, they flee and escape.
Yeah, I wonder, because if you put the two together, you almost have like the way in which natural dudes that don't believe in supernatural things try to explain the parting of the Red Sea today. Well, you know, there's this natural occurrence.
The Reed Sea.
In other words, it's explaining away. The idea that it would be in conjunction with a global earthquake would then to leave open the possibility that Jesus didn't do it. Whereas Jesus is clearly doing something that the armies are going to see him do it.
And it touches the nation of Israel.
Yeah.
So then they open up the gates.
But to me, the global earthquake is something very different. The global earthquake is Isaiah 24, and the earth is tottering like a drunkard, and it's an.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're probably distinct.
Okay, so one praise report and two questions. Just got back from Israel, and I talked to a believer.
How long were you there?
6 weeks.
I know it's forever that you were there.
Thank you. I talked to a believer there, and he said there's over 300 prayer rooms there.
That doesn't seem possible.
I mean, it's not all houses of prayer, but prayer rooms.
Yeah. Even a one-person prayer room.
I talked to a native, believer there.
And was he an American?
He actually was Korean. But
I was
going
to say he's American, and maybe added a little bit to it.
But God's raising up his Gideon's army in the land. The two questions I have is this. When Jesus marches in, how is he going to treat the nominal Muslims and the Orthodox Jews and nominal Christians? And the other question is, I talked to a taxi driver, a Muslim in Jerusalem, and he said, yeah, Jesus is going to return, you know, and there's this figure he's going to destroy and all. And then when I realize it, it's the opposite he's talking, right? Jesus is our Antichrist.
I don't think we have good answers for how he's going to treat them when he returns. There'll be so many shifts in the culture and dynamics and people fleeing and coming, and I don't think there's a good answer for that.
But I do think it's important to keep clear that the criteria for salvation doesn't change. Like, Jesus is still the way to the Father, and people are going to decide to follow him or not, to submit to him as king or to not, and that will affect what happens. I think that keeping that principle first and foremost kind of sorts out all the big questions, and the specifics aren't super clear as to how it all works out with the individuals.
And then how about the Muslim, do you guys know the Muslim end time scenario of, you know, could you kind of explain?
Let's not do that right now, though. Because I want to stick on Revelation 19 and 20. But we can do that sometime, but I would like to stay with this passage.
So my question was related to the Harlot Babylon religious system of Revelation 17 and 18, in that the way it was presented here is that it's kind of this tolerant, you know, come from your background, Hinduism, Buddhism,
right,
background, and hey, you'll be accepted as a prelude to the Antichrist system.
Right.
So my question is how does this harlot religious Babylonian system, I guess, relate to really, really intolerant Islamic jihadist fundamentalism?
I think the three most crazy friends that are frenemies, is that right?
It's, wow. If you say BFF, I'm out of here.
I don't think they're quite at that level, but wow. Frenemies is their rabbinic Judaism, radical Islam, and prophetic believers sitting in a prison cell because they would not yield. Going, I wouldn't yield. I didn't either. I respect that. Why didn't you yield? Those will be the three groups in a prison talking from completely different perspectives. That will be a bizarre conversation. I don't think they will yield. I think those three groups won't.
I was wondering if there's a interaction of something coming that supersedes.
No, I think it's just the good news of everybody's right and nobody's wrong. That ideology is growing right now. I think it's an ideology, not a religious system per se, but an ideology many people embrace. But I don't think those three groups will embrace it.
Question from John Ray.
Wait.
Oh, go for it.
I was jumping at the bed.
Don't be shy, Stuart. Come on.
You just stay up here.
Come on.
Stuart, just stay up here.
Just release it. Just release it.
Yeah, I just want to go back to your question about the lake of fire. I just want to kind of present something to you. I think that we have to understand that when it comes to the lake of fire, that it is consistent with the glory of God. That's the first thing. I think when we think about the lake of fire, we think it's like this.
Interesting because we don't think of the glory.
Yeah, like
of God.
It's this bad thing on the side, and so in light of that, I personally don't have a problem with the lake of fire being within the boundaries of the New Jerusalem when it comes upon the Middle East, and I'll give you a couple of reasons why. Reason number one: the glory of God is revealed in the New Jerusalem, right? We know that. Number one. Number two: we see the wrath of God in the bowls in the New Jerusalem in Revelation 15. There's a manifestation of wrath that happens in the context of the bowls from the New Jerusalem before they're released upon the earth. Thirdly, Revelation 14 says that the lake of fire, it says they're burning in the presence of the Lamb and the holy angels. And so that has to be.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So that has to be factored into that as well. Fourthly, the Edom in Isaiah 34 has some lake of fire descriptions, but in Malachi chapter 1, verse 4, it's called the territory of the wicked. So I can actually conceive of, the New Jerusalem boundaries in the Middle East, and there's a territory that is set aside for the wicked, but they're being consumed by the glory of God, because the lake of fire is not a different fire. If you look at Daniel chapter 7, the fire that comes from God's throne is the exact same fire that consumes the little horn, which is the lake of fire, according to Revelation 19. So I just wanted to throw some of those together. We can talk later, but because I don't want to take up the time. But I just wanted to
just for the archives, the lake of fire is not in New Jerusalem for sure. We're just working on that.
No,
you know more about the subject because he's taught on this for years. You have teased this out more than anybody I've ever met, actually. So I'm listening to him.
All right, John Ray, what is God's purpose for the millennial kingdom? Why not jump to the eternal kingdom? Mike said to demonstrate God's mercy in the darkness of man's heart.
No, so that's why the devil's released, is that.
Okay. Some time ago, I believe Mike also taught that God wants the saints to experience a righteous kingdom. Are there any other reasons?
Israel.
Expound on that a little bit. There are so many details
in the Old Testament, in the prophets, in the law. There are so many details related to Israel's destiny and what Israel's destiny means to the earth and what it expresses to the peoples of the earth. There's something that God from the beginning has ordained Israel to express to the earth in a way that blesses the earth. Romans 11. The fullness of Israel that's blessing to the all of the earth. It's not just that Jesus is in Jerusalem ruling Israel that blesses the whole earth. Israel's response, they're coming to Israel in Isaiah 2. They're coming in Micah 4. They're coming in Zechariah 8 to the city of truth to learn something. What we forget, the reason why God doesn't just skip to the end, is we forget how into process he is. Like, why didn't he skip to the end after the garden? Why didn't he obliterate Adam and Eve and just populate the earth with awesome? Why did he have a Satan in the first place? Why did he have two trees? Like that question can be extrapolated back from Revelation all the way to Genesis 2, because God has forever been a God of process and time as it relates to the human race. Therefore, there's so many weird prophecies about Gentiles learning from Israel. And so there's a process of learning and discovery that doesn't just begin with automatic Gentile knowledge of everything. He wants the Gentiles leaning into Israel, but he wants Israel, Deuteronomy 28-31, serving the Gentiles. And so there's a There's this mutual serving, even the way that God does Ephesians 2, family. He doesn't automatically start with Jewish-Gentile family. He does a process of reconciliation. He does a process of family building. And it's that very process of reconciliation, discovery, and learning, and mutual thanksgiving for one another that causes Paul to explode in worship in Romans 11. He explodes in worship because his point is, who is a God like God that would come up with this kind of plan by which he would reconcile two peoples in such a manner that one group would offer themselves, Romans 12, as a living sacrifice for the other, but the first group offered themselves for the redemption of the other related to the way in which they carry the seed. And so the process that produces mutual gratitude, the process that produces family, and the process that produces expressed promises by which the Gentiles learn, all of it is the millennial kingdom. There's just so much. I mean, Israel, the reason I said Israel and not everything I just said is because it's a gigantic answer. Thank you.
And it also expresses his character so much, because that's his patience, that's his faithfulness, that's his just his unwillingness to back out of what he said just because people are being difficult. Like, we do see the wisdom and his glory and his riches displayed in how he's laid it out.
I have a short comment and then a question. The comment is something I've never thought of. If Satan enters into the Antichrist, at the very end, there has to be a disembodiment of Satan. Clearly, that the Antichrist gets thrown into the lake of fire, but Satan doesn't. Somehow that's going to work.
Say, yeah. Whenever we talk about Satan incarnating in the Antichrist, it's like, that's tricky stuff. Right. We just can't quite say it that way.
Okay. Does it say it?
It doesn't say that?
Does it say it?
Because they're always distinct. Okay. He gives his authority to the Antichrist. He gives his power to the Antichrist.
I'm going to give you my thought.
Yeah, go ahead.
Here's what puzzles me about Satan. Because we talk about Satan worship. But actual Satan worship in our day does not involve a being at all. Satan worshipers worship themselves. From the beginning, you never see Satan drawing attention to himself. It's so perplexing. He's not trying to draw attention to himself from the beginning. He's trying to get everybody against God. He's even in the garden. He's not trying to get Adam and Eve to worship him. He's trying to get them to reject him. And it's like the Bible is one long satanic attempt at an apologetic for the foolishness of God to have an eternal companion. It just doesn't strike me that Satan actually wants us to go, wow, Satan's awesome. It seems like Genesis to Revelation is his attempt to get us to go, wow, God's not. And so even at the very end, he doesn't turn the earth to himself. He gives all his power to a man. That only makes sense in the context of Ephesians. The reverse, that the fullness of the love of God would make a spectacle of the powers and the accuser of the brethren. Why? Why is he the accuser of the brethren? Because he's ultimately the accuser of God. And the accuser of God, that I was telling Mike earlier, I'll just tell you what I told him. I see Jerusalem as the Antichrist's, you know, Michelangelo's David, Sistine Chapel, Pièce de Résistance. I see that as his resume to the earth as to why he should be worshipped. But I see Antichrist as Satan's Sistine Chapel. It's his apologetic for why man is unworthy of the eternal companion, which ultimately accuses God and his plan. Because again, think about it. Why does this being that constantly could step out from behind the curtain and be worshipped, why is he so consistently content to stay behind the curtain and let somebody else receive the worship? It just seems like he's up to something else than standing on a platform and going, I'm awesome. He wants man to stand on the platform and say that he's awesome, because when man says he's awesome, he's implicitly saying that God's not Antichrist. It's just, to me, the end game is not sing songs to Satan. The end game is sing songs to me, and Satan wins.
Question.
It's not my question. Sorry. I'm thinking in terms of so singing, songwriting, explaining these cosmic realities to people who mostly disagree or hate God's judgment. They don't like talking about the lake of fire or any of this stuff. How do you emotionally go forward knowing that God doesn't delight in the destruction of the wicked? He's removing everything that hinders love. I love that phrase. I get that. But how do you reconcile that with all of the details, the gory details that he gives us that are forever written. I mean, things like the birds eating all of this
flesh
and all
that. That's cleanup. That actually
right.
makes sense.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
That one I appreciate, actually.
It's not just that we go, well, he's just removing things that hinder love, and that's the end of the story. It's like passage after passage. I'm going to drown them with fire. I'm going to make a spectacle of them. I'm going to actually take my time and trample them. That, to me, I mean, other than just to say it, which maybe that's what we should do, I'm going, how do we go to the next level instead of just saying, hey, God judges and we love him and we stand with him, to explaining it the way the scripture does. So that's the wrestle I'm in. And that's
just a short answer is that when we understand the intensity of the rebellion, we get it, the intensity of the violence. Right. And it's because we don't get the rebellion and the hardness, that's why we don't get the violence.
I want to say one more thing related to my really long question, answer to your non-question. Think about what I think you're going to remember what I just said about Satan's plan when you see God in his full beauty. The horror of Satan's plan will be made more horrible when we see God in his full beauty. God, there is a being, we're going to say it a billion years from now, there was a being that tried to convince the human race that that being was ugly and unworthy of our worship. It's going to be more horrific when we see God's beauty.
Well, and for me, the thing that keeps me grounded is to keep going back to the Lord's beauty. And when I am convinced that he's good, and when I'm convinced that he has gone to the greatest depths of love, and then I see him do something that hits me as extreme, like if there's already trust built there, he is good though, and he is love, then this is actually what it takes. Rather than starting, this is an awful thing, I have to reconcile how a good God could do an awful thing. Going, he is a good God, which means he doesn't do this kind of stuff unless that's what will bring the good. And it's kind of a lame analogy, but I think of like if you know somebody who's super, super patient, they don't get angry easily, they don't get rattled easily. If you come upon them and they are fuming over something, you're like, whoa, what happened? Because they don't just do that. And so I think putting the beauty of God at the center of it helps make sense out of the rest of it, because I know who I believe. And if he's doing this, then I really, really, really do believe that this is the best thing to bring forth his glory and to bring forth people into love.
But last point, I know we're supposed to give short answers because it's late and you're tired, but I got to say this. He does take his time, but not because he's a masochist. He takes his time to do it 21 judgments instead of one. One would do. 21 judgments doesn't speak of just intensity. 21 judgments speaks of love and mercy to me.
I have two questions. one about Antichrist and Babylon. Antichrist. Satan gives all his power to Antichrist. So he just gives the power. That means that they're not really one, you know, like.
Right, they aren't one.
They're not one. Okay. I thought they were like,
no,
they become one.
Like Chris said, one goes to the lake of fire, the other goes to the bottomless pit. They're two different persons.
Okay. Think about this all over again. Babylon. When the Antichrist power they crash or strike the Babylon. The first destruction of Babylon. There's a fire and all that. Don't they completely destroy it? So that there will be no human being can live in it? Because it seems like from the understanding of the notes, it seems like the Satan, the Antichrist attacks it, but it's still livable or still manageable for people to live. I couldn't get that understanding.
Yeah, I don't think we could tease it down to that degree.
Okay, so when does from your note, the understanding is that Babylon gets destroyed in the middle of the 7 year? Is that it?
That would be the religious system.
Just the religious system?
Yes, just the religious system, yes. And replaced by the Antichrist system.
Okay, but doesn't the, you know, like the Zechariah 5, the prophets see, doesn't the religious system and economic system goes together? You know, it's like
they yes, cannot. No, be yes, no.
Yes, no.
Didn't quite work. There's three hooks. One's religious, one's economic, one's political. There's three hooks that are being pulled in this whole storyline in different ways. And to tease it out exactly as to which hook is winning at what time isn't super easy.
Can you destroy one without the other? I mean, I think it's possible, but I don't think you can, like, separate them. You know, like, if you destroy one, others go with it.
Okay. There you go.
It seems like that could be a possibility. That could be. Keep searching that one out. Okay. Why is death thrown into the lake? Is it a person? Did it lose its purpose? Why was lake death?
I think
it's
the spirit of death is, I don't know, because in the fourth seal, death follows Hades or Hades follows death, which one follows the other. So it's like a spirit and it's bigger than what we
death and hell follows, yeah.
Yes.
According to Johnny Cash.
Nice. Two quick ones. First one is, when Jesus came the first time, they were expecting him to come like he comes the second time. And now when he's coming the second time, we expect him to come like he came the first time.
Ooh,
and so one of my questions would be, what is the Spirit saying to the church and to us about, like, when you read Revelation and you're seeing the first coming of Christ and the second coming of Christ, and both times they miss it, like, what's the Spirit saying out of that?
Obey the Lord.
Okay, that's okay.
That's what he's saying.
Yeah. So then, the second question would be: you talked about the rulers being there, all drawn in by the Antichrist. Do you believe that the rulers that are there have a choice to respond to the Lord rightly in that moment?
No, they've already taken the mark of the beast. They're already reprobate by then.
Okay, so they're reprobate. Yeah.
I think they had a chance previously.
Yeah, they had a chance previously, but they've gone past that. They're irreversibly hardened.
Psalm 2 isn't just a blueprint for the future. Psalm 2, I think, is a prophetic oracle the church will preach to nations leaders.
Yes.
This is the last online question. I'm having trouble understanding how a vast multitude of people could be deceived by Satan at the end of the millennium to fight Jesus again. How could a number as many as the sand of the sea turn against Jesus? How could that happen under Jesus' and the saints' rule through the millennium?
This is the mystery of iniquity.
And the mystery of Adam and Eve.
Well, that's the same thing.
Right.
At the end of the day, the mystery of godliness and the mystery of iniquity are two mysteries. Why can people sin in the presence of glory? That is a mysterious reality.
Yeah, and it's not an unprecedented one. Satan, angels, Adam and Eve, that group.
Yeah. Go ahead.
In Ezekiel chapters 38 to 39, yeah, mentioned a battle in the land of
Israel, yeah.
Gog
and Magog, yeah.
Yeah, Magog. And also in Revelation chapter 20, verse 8, mentioned a battle in Magog. Two different battles.
Yes.
Oh.
Gog, in my opinion, Gog is a prophetic title, like Caesar, like Pope, like that kind of thing. Gog isn't the same man. It's a prophetic title of the number one demonic adversary on a global level at the key moment of changing of history. There's only two Gogs, two different individuals. They operate in that function.
Okay, thank you.
That's how I see it.
So I would love clarity on a criteria for understanding what is literal versus symbolic. I was trained from Omega like 14 years ago.
Yeah. Is your name Sam?
Yes, that's right.
Hi, Sam.
Hey. I give him a note, so it's not his, he's not prophesying right now.
But if you know the miracle of me remembering it.
There you go. Forgive me for
what I've done today.
There you go. Thank you.
That is almost a bigger miracle than me prophesying.
So my understanding of just basically taking everything literal, especially if it's explained by an angel, is what I understood. I went to Bible college, and they got...
No, no, it's okay. That's not it.
That's what I remembered.
It's literal unless the text indicates it's symbolic.
Sorry, okay.
Not necessarily opposite. Explained by an angel. Right. Yeah,
so I took that key indicates. To Bible college. It got ripped up, and then I went to seminary, and then it got ripped up again. And what people kept saying is, you're not understanding apocalyptic literature. You don't understand the genre. You're reading it through your Western lenses. And then I started reading apocalyptic literature because they made us. And then I'm like, oh, wow, everything is very symbolic. And so then... I can roll with you to say that, okay, let's just take the word for what it is. But then even in verse 15 of chapter 19, you mentioned the sharp sword. And when you said it, you said, I don't think it's like an actual sword, and then you kind of explained it. And I just don't know the warrant for when you can call it. It's probably more like a word of judgment or releasing it. But then over here, it's a literal horse when you could even, you know, point to times where it's, you know, horses of fire, and I'm just struggling. I'm not trying to challenge you. I feel
I wouldn't mind if you did.
Yeah, I just feel a little like I feel honestly confused now with Revelation after.
But give the alternative as it relates to how we should apply a hermeneutic that understands apocalyptic literature. Uh-huh. What does that mean practically in terms of understanding the text?
Yeah, I don't like the alternative either.
Okay? No. I'm asking what is proposed, and what does an apocalyptic genre demand of us versus what the seminary guy says it does? What does the genre demand?
Sure.
And who says it? Who says they demand it?
Right. I guess it's...
And I'll give you one last point.
Sure, go for it.
I'll sneak ahead.
Yes.
I'm not asking a loaded question, but if the apocalyptic genre demands what the seminary guy says it demands of us, then they have to answer for the early church fathers and how the early church fathers understood Revelation as it relates to, for example, little Antichrist. And so meaning they understood it was apocalyptic genre, they knew John. And so the way in which they understood it was actually more of what you went into Bible college with in terms of what we have from their writings. And so what that means to me is nobody's trying. It's not about being literal. It's about being grammatical, historical, or contextual in our understanding, which means that which John was writing, what was he drawing from? That's the first, like knowing Mike like I know him, he's trying to figure out what allusions John is making to Old Testament prophecy to build his description. So we have with Revelation two things, not just apocalyptic genre, we have a prophetic genre, which means that there's Old Testament prophecies informing what John is seeing, and he's using that language to describe it. So we don't just have the text in front of us. For sure. We have 300 Old Testament passages that we have to interpret as well. And Jews, early church fathers, etc., interpreted that in a fairly grammatical, historical way. In other words, fairly straightforward to shorten the discussion. But the big point is... The grammatical, historical, what was John drawing from when he wrote it? What was he trying to communicate to the audience? How did the audience understand it? Those are the contextual kind of considerations we're trying to keep in mind, even more than literal symbolic.
So I love that. So for that specific passage, can you give me understanding of how you landed it's more of a, it's not a literal sword here versus literal horses that we would have in...
Yeah, I don't think a sword, a metal sword, comes out of a human being's mouth. I don't think there's any context for that anywhere. But there is.
So that gives me lots of questions, right? Like,
well, yeah, but,
seeing
but
a sword
the command of his mouth,
right.
That to me is what it means.
But I still have equal amount of questions of having, like, these spirit horses. Like, I don't have a category for that in the heavens right now from any scripture outside of any passages in Isaiah that is speaking of maybe the new heavens, new earth, you know?
Well, you
so, like, there's questions on both sides. What's that?
You got Zechariah. Zechariah 1.
For I horses. Say, let's end this conversation and have a little talk afterwards and dismiss the meeting.
Yes.
Amen. No, you don't have to go. You can keep talking, but I'm just saying, let's end this. Yeah.